Chapter 11. Al-Qaeda's Quest for Weapons of Mass Destruction. Osama bin Laden in 1999. Acquiring nuclear and chemical weapons is a religious duty. Bin Laden could not have been more explicit about Al-Qaeda's policy on weapons of mass destruction, WMD, in the statement he made 2 years before the 9/11 attacks. Beginning in the early 90s, Al-Qaeda members made efforts to acquire nuclear materials while the group was based in Sudan. When Al-Qaeda later relocated to Afghanistan, bin Laden started meeting with former senior nuclear scientists from Pakistan and may have attempted to purchase nuclear materials from the former Soviet Union. At the same time, members of Al-Qaeda also started experimenting with crude chemical weapons and began to educate themselves about biological weapons. From its earliest days, some members of Al-Qaeda dreamed of inflicting mass casualty attacks with WMD. Paulo José de Almeida Santos is a Portuguese member of Al-Qaeda who joined the group in 1990. After an 8-year jail term in an Italian prison for attempting to kill the King of Afghanistan in Rome in 1991, Santos settled down somewhere in East Africa, where he was interviewed by José Pedro Castanheira of the Portuguese magazine Expresso in April 2002. In that interview, he said that Al-Qaeda's leaders initially had a somewhat negative attitude to the use of WMDs. An excerpt follows. "I drew up a terrible, diabolical plan to kill Israelis. Something like using mercury to poison the waters, which would poison the harvests and the cereals. Horrific. Now the thought of those diabolical plans sends shivers down my spine. It was rejected by Al-Qaeda's leadership. I spent a few days in a medical library in Pakistan studying synthetic poisons which could be used on the skin and which rapidly enter the blood vessels like many creams do. The idea was to create a poison which by simple contact with a person's skin could kill in a matter of minutes or hours. In Peshawar there were a number of people we knew to be Western spies. I made a suggestion. Why don't we catch a spy, an American, a European or whatever, take him home with us and carry out experiments on him? Al-Qaeda said that in the first place it was necessary to ask the theological opinion of a sheikh, religious authority. We went to see a sheikh who, when he heard the proposal, almost kicked me. He was furious. 'You want to do such tests on human beings? Do you think we are Nazis?' They then said, 'Experiment on animals.' We did an experiment on a rabbit, but it didn't work. The best animals for experimenting on are supposed to be pigs because they have the same metabolism as humans. But where do you find a pig in Muslim Pakistan?" Jamal al-Fadl is a member of Al-Qaeda who testified for the prosecution in the New York trial of four men implicated in the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. In the mid-1990s, al-Fadl lived in Sudan, where he witnessed Al-Qaeda's attempts to acquire uranium. Jamal al-Fadl: "I remember Abu Fadl al-Maki, a bin Laden aide related to Osama by marriage, called me and he told me, 'We hear somebody in Khartoum, he got uranium, and we need you to go and study that. Is that true or not?' We went to another office in Jamboria Street in Khartoum. The seller of the uranium told me, 'Are you serious? You want uranium?' I tell him, 'Yes. I know people, they are very serious and they want to buy it. They need the information about uranium. They want to know which quality, which country make it. And after that, we're going to talk with you about the price.' He say, 'I'm going to give you this information and we need $1,500,000. We need the money outside of Sudan.' And he say, 'This is for the uranium, but he need commission for himself.' I went to Iklak Company in Baraka Building in Khartoum City. And I told Al-Qaeda member Abu Rida al-Suri about the whole information, and he say, 'Tell him we have our machine, electric machine. We're going to check the uranium. But first, we want information. We want to see the cylinder, and we need information about the quality.' And after a few minutes, they bring a big bag, and they open it. And it is a cylinder, like 2 to 3 feet tall. A lot is written in the cylinder. The information was, like, engraved. I remember it say, 'South Africa,' and serial number. It's all in English. However, the deal for the uranium seemed never to have gone through. Mamdou Mahmoud Salim, a founding member of Al-Qaeda, also allegedly led its efforts to acquire uranium in the early 1990s. In September 1998, after his arrest in Germany, an FBI special agent filed a complaint charging Salim with one count of conspiracy to commit murder and one count of conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction. Excerpts of the complaint follow. In late 1993, after bin Laden had issued a private fatwa to Al-Qaeda members and associates indicating that the United States was an enemy that needed to be attacked, members of Al-Qaeda made efforts to procure enriched uranium for the purpose of developing nuclear weapons. In particular, a document relating to a proposed purchase of uranium was routed to Salim for his review, and after reviewing the document, he indicated that the project to purchase uranium should proceed. On May 14, 1998, bin Laden issued a statement following the Indian government's nuclear tests 3 days earlier at a remote desert test site less than 100 miles from the Pakistan border. The world was awakened last Tuesday by the sound of 3 underground Indian nuclear explosions, accompanied by explosive statements from the Hindu government in India. The leaders of the Islamic world were struck by political blindness and failed to see this danger. We call upon the Muslim nation in general, and Pakistan and its army in particular, to prepare for the jihad imposed by Allah and terrorize the enemy by preparing the force necessary thereto. This should include a nuclear force to raise fears among all enemies led by the Zionist Christian Alliance to overthrow the Islamic world and the Hindu enemy occupier of Muslim Kashmir. Dr. Sultan Bashir Uddin Mahmood, a recently retired senior Pakistani nuclear scientist sympathetic to the Taliban, met with bin Laden and Mullah Omar in Kandahar in 2000 and 2001. He says his contacts with bin Laden were entirely innocent. Nuclear proliferation experts and the U.S. government believe these meetings concerned Al-Qaeda's quest for nuclear and radiological weapons. Dr. Mahmoud gave a rare interview to the Pakistani newspaper, The News, extracts of which follow. "I have never been in contact with the Al-Qaeda terrorists, but I met Mullah Omar, members of his Council of Ministers, as well as Osama bin Laden, only to seek their cooperation in pursuing the goals of my charitable organization, Umma Tamir Inao, UTN. I met Osama to seek $3 million for manpower and land development projects in Afghanistan. But he refused any help, saying, 'All my accounts are frozen.' I feel bad the way everybody played up my meeting with Osama in the context of the transfer of nuclear technology. I never thought the meeting would lead to so many complications." The following are excerpts of a written statement by the U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill upon the designation of Umma Tamir Inao, UTN, as a terrorist organization. UTN was ostensibly established as a charity by several Pakistani nuclear scientists, including Dr. Mahmoud. "Today we are blocking the assets of a terrorist organization, UTN, and 3 of its directors because they finance terrorism. UTN and its directors provided more than money to Al-Qaeda. They provided knowledge of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. UTN's founder, Mahmoud, was the former chief designer and director of an atomic reactor in Pakistan. He was joined in UTN by a number of other prominent Pakistani scientists, retired military officers, and industrialists. On a number of occasions, UTN delegations traveled to Afghanistan, where UTN directors met with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda leaders and discussed nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Even after September 11th, UTN representatives sought to provide bin Laden and Taliban with still more devastating weapons of mass destruction." After the fall of the Taliban, CNN acquired some 200 videotapes from what appears to have been al-Qaeda's main video library. On some of the tapes, al-Qaeda members experiment on dogs with chemical weapons, probably cyanide gas. Those experiments were likely carried out in the Darunta training camp outside of Jalalabad, a camp run by an Egyptian with the wonderful alias of Abu Khabab, who headed al-Qaeda's WMD program. What follows is a description of one of the filmed experiments. A dog is in a cage in a room. There is a pressure cooker nearby. There's a rope tied around the dog's neck that goes outside of the cage. A white gas is introduced into the cage. A man with an Egyptian accent can be heard saying, "Start counting the time." The dog starts barking and moaning. The dog is nervous and tries to break loose from the rope. The dog kicks hard and his tail is moving. Finally, the dog moves no more. Abu Khabab, al-Qaeda's WMD chief, singled out Uzbekistan, a country on Afghanistan's northern border that was formerly part of the Soviet Union, as a possible source of materials for his chemical weapons program. This is an extract from an order he wrote on April 2, 2001, in a document recovered near Jalalabad. "Obtain the liquid and non-liquid chemicals as soon as possible from Uzbekistan because we need them. Take all necessary precautions to ensure the correct delivery of the materials and the lives of our men. Try and recruit Uzbek army individuals who are experienced in this sphere. Procure necessary face masks, protective clothing, and protective footwear. Execute this order without delay." Abu Walid al-Misri, the editor of Al-Imara, the Emirate magazine, the Arabic language magazine of the Taliban. The dreams of the hardline wing in al-Qaeda, which sometimes appeared in the form of demands, dealt with the need and importance of possessing weapons of mass destruction and storing some of them on American territory to be used in a fast and direct response to any American aggression against Afghanistan. The conclusion reached was that al-Qaeda must possess weapons for defense, based on what can be obtained or supplied in the nuclear, biological, or chemical fields, so that in a crisis, if the other side used weapons of mass destruction, it will not escape a deadly punishment. Another group believed that these type of weapons, if bin Laden could obtain them, would be tactical in nature only by virtue of their primitiveness and weak destructive capability. However, they will continue to call them weapons of mass destruction to create fear. They are primitive weapons with tactical and not strategic capabilities. In other words, using them will give the Mujahideen credibility, prestige, and psychological influence. The people close to bin Laden believed that these destructive weapons would greatly enhance the combat capability and psychological influence of the al-Qaeda fighters. The most important questions were, if such weapons could be obtained, will they be used against the enemy on Muslim territory or against the enemy on his own territory? Will the enemy forces be targeted by these weapons if they were obtained, or will the civilians in their country also be targeted? There were different interpretations and views in this respect, and then more questions were asked. Which of these weapons will be more appropriate for the current situation of the Mujahideen, the nuclear, chemical, or biological? Should the information regarding the ways of obtaining such weapons remain secret, or should it be disseminated among the Mujahideen groups in all the areas? Others raised questions about the possibility of mixing the weapon of suicide action, the only remaining deterrent weapon in the hands of the Muslims, and those weapons of mass destruction. They noted that the security measures by the enemy have greatly reduced the effect of suicide operations, and the introduction of these weapons could greatly enhance the value of suicide operations and their effect on the enemy. As to the WMD proposals, bin Laden did not approve them in the first place, and that was obvious from his repeated theory that the United States could not bear two or three strikes from him. but he refused to voice publicly his rejection of the idea, probably because of his extreme politeness with those around him. Another reason was that his right-hand man in Al-Qaeda, Abu Hafs, led the Hawks wing and strongly supported the acquisition of new resources, especially WMD. But he did not make up his mind about the strategy of using these weapons, postponing this until they were actually acquired. Abu Hafs took charge of the WMD issue and acted with his known stubbornness and determination. One of the documents stored on the Al-Qaeda computer recovered by the Wall Street Journal after the fall of the Taliban was a letter from Ayman al-Zawahiri to Abu Hafs, dated April 15, 1999, an excerpt of which follows. The enemy, the West, started thinking about these chemical and biological weapons before World War I. Despite their extreme danger, we only became aware of them when the enemy drew our attention to them by repeatedly expressing concerns that they can be produced simply with easily available materials. The irony of Zawahiri's comment about Al-Qaeda's growing interest in chemical and biological weapons is worth considering. It was Western concerns about the proliferation of chemical and biological weapons that drew Al-Qaeda's attention to these weapons in the first place. Abu Walid al-Misri. The Taliban authorities in Kabul had in their possession a considerable quantity of radioactive materials seized from smugglers who came from the countries of the former Soviet Union, especially Tajikistan, and other shipments that were left behind by the Soviets in Afghanistan, some of which were for medical use and some for some unknown use. The Taliban officials in Kabul threw up a heavy curtain of secrecy about their nuclear secrets and always preferred to open their hearts to the Pakistanis. They did not trust the Arabs most of the time. The Pakistanis paid small sums of money, but obtained much more than their value in the form of radioactive materials that they alone knew their worth, and which probably helped them in their nuclear program that came to the surface several years later. The Taliban officials allowed the Arabs to examine what was left of these materials.
This ends Disc 12. The Osama bin Laden I Know, Disc 13.
In September 1997, 5 months after we interviewed bin Laden together, Peter Juvenal, the veteran British cameraman who has reported on Afghanistan since 1980, told me that he had heard about a group of Afghans selling nuclear materials from the former Soviet Union. They approached an Afghan friend of Juvenal's, who had in turn told him about the offer of nuclear materials. The material came in 5 containers, inscribed with Russian writing. The sellers of the material claimed that they have sold other weapons-grade material to Iranian buyers for as little as $2,000. The sellers were based in Mazar-i-Sharif in northern Afghanistan, near the border with the former Soviet Union. Common sense would suggest that this was an ideal location to sell nuclear materials from the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union. Peter Juvenal faxed me information about the markings that appeared on one of the boxes of the radioactive materials the Afghans were selling. A notation indicating uranium, a notation indicating plutonium, October 1988, and a notation indicating the Soviet Union. Peter Juvenal. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there have always been rumors about nuclear products or bits of plutonium floating through Afghanistan. Looking back in perspective, I actually think that most of them are an elaborate con trick by people in Russia who persuaded Afghans to buy nuclear material. It could be radioactive waste from an X-ray machine. So there was all this whispering about plutonium and uranium and what have you for sale. I personally think it was an elaborate scam. The information about the nuclear materials came from an Afghan friend. He was sick. I think he looked at this stuff with a friend in Mazar-i-Sharif. I think we had given him instructions to run a watch over the stuff and see if the watch stopped. All these things he did. And then he was sick, and his friend was sick the next day. He said his eyebrows started falling out. I always presumed that it was some sort of radioactive waste. Maybe it came from an X-ray machine in a hospital. After consulting with a nuclear physicist, we concluded that the nuclear materials were, in fact, nothing of the kind, but were likely some form of radioactive waste. However, this waste can be useful for terrorists wanting to detonate a radiological weapon or a dirty bomb, which marries conventional explosives to widely available radioactive materials, such as waste from industrial processes or hospitals. While such bombs would kill relatively few people, they would cause widespread disruption if exploded in an urban area because of both the resulting panicked reaction of the populace and the fact that teams of specialists would have to be sent in to decontaminate the affected areas over long periods of time. Abu Khabab, al-Qaeda's WMD chief, in a letter recovered in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, spelled out the possible uses of radioactive materials by al-Qaeda. As you instructed us, you will find attached a summary of the discharges from a traditional nuclear reactor, amongst which are radioactive elements that could be used for military ends. One can use them to contaminate an area or to halt the advance of the enemy. It is possible to get more information from our Pakistani friends who have great experience in this sphere. Following are excerpts from a memorandum outlining the American Defense Department's rationale for continuing to hold U.S. citizen Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant. Padilla, a former small-time criminal from Florida, met with both Abu Zubaydah, who recruited for al-Qaeda, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the operational planner of 9/11, in Pakistan in early 2002, supposedly to discuss a radiological attack on the United States. Padilla was arrested at Chicago O'Hare Airport on May 8, 2002. Padilla admits that after crossing into Pakistan, he met Abu Zubaydah again at a guest house in Lahore, Pakistan. After staying there for 1 month, Padilla, his future accomplice, and several others traveled to Faisalabad, where Abu Zubaydah again joined them. Padilla states that he and his accomplice approached Abu Zubaydah with an operation in which they would travel to the United States to detonate a nuclear bomb they learned to make on the Internet. Padilla claims that Abu Zubaydah was skeptical of the idea, but nonetheless told them that he would send them to Karachi to present the idea to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM. KSM was at the time al-Qaeda's leading operational planner and organizer. Abu Zubaydah arranged for Padilla and his accomplice to make the proposal to KSM. Padilla's admissions are corroborated by senior al-Qaeda detainee number one, who states that Abu Zubaydah claimed to have thought the nuclear bomb idea was not feasible from the beginning, but thought explosives wrapped in uranium, that is, a dirty bomb, was much more feasible. According to this detainee, Abu Zubaydah warned Padilla and his accomplice that the dirty bomb plot was not as easy to do as they thought, but they seemed convinced they could do it without getting caught. This detainee states that Abu Zubaydah thought that Padilla and his accomplice seemed knowledgeable in explosives, had received explosives training, and were jihadis, but that he did not remember them from the camps, did not think the two were members of al-Qaeda, and did not think Padilla was willing to do a martyrdom operation. This senior al-Qaeda detainee has stated further that Abu Zubaydah intended to use Padilla and his accomplice in his own future operations, but sent them to KSM instead due to their impatience. Abu Zubaydah wrote a reference letter to KSM concerning Padilla and his accomplice. Abu Zubaydah provided money for both men to travel to Karachi to meet KSM to present the plan. Abu Zubaydah advised KSM of the dirty bomb project and that he did not think it practical, but asked KSM to evaluate the proposal. Abu Zubaydah added that KSM could use them in his operations in the United States if he so wished. Abu Zubaydah sent Padilla and the accomplice to KSM in Karachi in mid-March 2002. Suleiman Abu Khaif, a Kuwaiti who served as al-Qaeda's official spokesman, wrote a three-part essay titled In the Shadow of the Lances, which appeared on Al-Nida, The Call, the organization's website, in June 2002. Abu Khaif lays out an extraordinary case for al-Qaeda having the right to kill and maim millions of Americans using weapons of mass destruction, excerpts of which follow. Why were millions of people astounded by what happened to America on September 11th? Did the world think that anything else would happen? What happened to America is something natural, an expected event for a country that uses terror, arrogant policy, and suppression against the nations and the peoples, and imposes a single method, thought, and way of life, as if the people of the entire world are clerks in its government offices and employed by its commercial companies and institutions. For 50 years in Palestine, the Jews, with the blessing and support of the Americans, carried out abominations of murder, suppression, abuse, and exile. The Jews exiled nearly 5 million Palestinians and killed nearly 260,000. They wounded nearly 180,000 and crippled nearly 160,000. Due to the American bombings and siege of Iraq, a reference to the UN sanctions placed on Iraq after the first Gulf War, more than 1,200,000 Muslims were killed in the past decade. According to the numbers, we still are at the beginning of the way. The Americans have still not tasted from our hands what we have tasted from theirs. The number of killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon are but a tiny part of the exchange for those killed in Palestine, Somalia, Sudan, the Philippines, Bosnia, Kashmir, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. We have not reached parity with them. We have the right to kill 4 million Americans, 2 million of them children, and to exile twice as many and wound and cripple hundreds of thousands. Furthermore, it is our right to fight them with chemical and biological weapons so as to afflict them with the fatal maladies that have afflicted the Muslims because of the Americans' chemical and biological weapons. America knows only the language of force. America is kept at bay by blood alone. Abu Musab al-Suri, a Syrian al-Qaeda member and longtime bin Laden confidant, released this statement to jihadist websites on January 25, 2005. I feel sorry because there were no weapons of mass destruction in the planes that attacked New York and Washington on 9/11. We might have been relieved of the biggest number possible of voters who elected Bush for a second term. The last option remains the destruction of America by strategic operations through nuclear, chemical, and germ weapons of mass destruction, if the Mujahideen were able to get them, in cooperation with those who possess them, or through purchasing them, or through manufacturing and using primitive atomic bombs called dirty bombs, radiological weapons. Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer, interviewed bin Laden after the 9/11 attacks. I interviewed him in 98. In that interview, I put in this question that, according to some reports, you have weapons of mass destruction and you are trying to acquire some nuclear weapons. At that time, he ignored my question. He said, next question. So I repeated my question again on the 8th of November 2001. And he responded then, we have nuclear deterrence, and this is for our defense. After the interview, we were having breakfast, and when breakfast was finished, he brought some tea for us. And during the tea, I was interested to get some more information on this nuclear weapon issue. So I engaged Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri in a conversation, and I asked, it is difficult to believe that you have a nuclear weapon. How can you purchase these kinds of weapons? He said, Mr. Hamid Mir, it is not difficult. If you have $30 million, you can have these kind of nuclear suitcase bombs from the black market of Central Asia. It's not difficult. Bin Laden talked about chemical and nuclear weapons. He never used the word biological because I asked this question about anthrax. Some people think that you are behind the anthrax attacks in America. There was a series of post-9/11 attacks involving anthrax-laced letters in Florida, Washington, and New York that killed five. He laughed and said, "We don't have any link with these attacks. Next question." Osama bin Laden's statement to Hamid Mir on November 8, 2001. "I wish to declare that if America used chemical or nuclear weapons against us, then we may reply with chemical and nuclear weapons. We have the weapons as a deterrent." After his capture by U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan in late November 2001, the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, told his interrogators that the scuttlebutt around the training camps was that there would be another wave of attacks following 9/11 that would involve WMD. An excerpt follows of the Department of Defense's interview of John Walker Lind on December 1, 2001. "The second attack was to take place immediately before or at the beginning of Ramadan, December 2001. The second phase of attacks could involve the use of unspecified biological agents, possible attacks on natural gas resources, or nuclear weapons facilities in the United States." Field comment: source was making assumptions and conjectures based on talk among his colleagues. "The second phase was supposed to make the United States forget about the first phase. The third phase was supposed to finish the United States and was to take place within the next 6 months." Field comment: source was making assumptions and conjectures based on talk among his colleagues. One of the less appreciated positive outcomes of the American war in Afghanistan in the winter of 2001 is that it ended al-Qaeda's fledgling WMD program. As a result, it is highly improbable that bin Laden would have acquired or assembled even the crudest of nuclear weapons. However, it's certainly the case that al-Qaeda experimented with chemical weapons and made a series of efforts to acquire nuclear materials, efforts that seem to have come to naught. Nuclear proliferation experts dismiss as myths the existence of Russian so-called suitcase nukes. So Ayman al-Zawahiri's apparent claim to Hamid Mir that al-Qaeda had purchased such bombs was simple bravado on his part. Nonetheless, whatever the merits or demerits of the U.S. government's case that Jose Padilla was planning a dirty bomb attack in the U.S., it is certainly possible that al-Qaeda or its affiliates could launch a radiological attack sometime in the future. In fact, it is somewhat surprising such an attack has not happened already, as the technical know-how to build a radiological weapon is not much more than a graduate-level physics degree.